All right, guys, put your headphones on, if you would, please. Some of you will remember rolling your trousers up to the knee and turning stones over in our rivers in an attempt to catch slippery eels. Our streams and rivers enjoyed abundant stocks of these strange snake-like fish. But sadly, not anymore. Numbers are down dramatically, I'm told, and not just here in Ireland. The European eel is on the critically endangered species list. Since the 1970s, numbers reaching Europe is thought to have declined by around 90%, possibly even 98%. Contributing factors include overfishing, parasites, barriers to migration, such as hydroelectric dams, and changes in the North Atlantic Oscillation, a Gulf Stream and North Atlantic Drift. European eel eggs hatch in the depths of the Sargasso Sea in the Western Atlantic, and much of the European eel's life history was a mystery for centuries, as scientists couldn't find any discernible sex organs. Indeed, much of our eel's life cycle remains mysterious today. We're joined by Lucy Cook to enlighten us a little on how much we know and don't know. Lucy's a zoologist, TV presenter, and author of The Unexpected Truth About Animals. Lucy, hello.
Hi there. Hi.
Lovely to speak with you. Tell us a little bit about your first encounter with eels.
I was obsessed with eels from a very young age, actually. My dad, when I was a small child, and I was an only child, basically. My half-sister's much older, so I kept to myself. And my father had sunk an old Victorian bath into the garden. I wanted to create the perfect pond ecosystem in. I was a very geeky child. And so my dad would drive me off to the marshes nearby, Romney Marsh, and I'd go fishing for whatever I could find to stock my pond. And the animals came two by two in my watery ark. I had sticklebacks and frogs and newts and whirligig beetles and all these wonderful creatures. But what eluded my net, or at least my hands actually, were eels, because I did manage to catch them. They were small, probably about the length and thickness of a pencil. They were elvers, young eels. But obviously every time, I don't know, have you ever tried to hold an eel?
Yeah, they certainly are very slippery, aren't they? They just slither off.
Oh, I mean, they are. I've been told by experts now that there is a way that you can actually hold onto an eel by pinching them behind their head and into their gills, which doesn't sound particularly friendly. But as a child, I didn't know how to do that. And I'd try and grab them and then they'd slither off into the grass, more like a snake than a fish out of water. So I became slightly obsessed with eels. It turns out I wasn't the first zoologist to become obsessed with eels, how they have tormented science since Aristotle.
They certainly have quite a life cycle, Lucy. There's no doubt about that. Just in terms of holding an eel, what I have found on working with eels in the past is, can you imagine this now? If you lift your middle finger, I should say, and then you trap the eel then gently but firmly inside that over the other two fingers, right and left of the middle finger. And that will actually hold your eel quite firmly.
If only I'd known you as a small child, you would have made my childhood so much happier.
Because it's so frustrating. Because they are so slimy, yeah. And every time you have one, you think you have him, and the next minute, he's gone again on you. But that was the only way I could find in the past where I could actually hold on to them.
Have they found the reproductive parts?
Well, certainly in the context of the reproduction, which Lucy has very, very clearly outlined, reproduction then happens down in the Sargasso Sea, as far as we know, because we find the juveniles, but we haven't got photographs of them actually mating down there. But certainly in terms of the female reproductive parts, I think, Lucy, they have found those. The males seem to mature at a later stage on their way back out. Have they actually found the testes on the male eels now at this stage?
Yes, they have. No, the sort of hunt for the reproductive organs of the eel went on from Aristotle was the first to try and find how eels' reproductive organs. And he thought, because he couldn't find them, he thought that eels actually reproduced by spontaneous generation. And he was a brilliant scientist, Aristotle. You know, he really sort of pioneered scientific thinking. And he'd sliced up millions of eels. And unlike any other fish that he opened up, he couldn't find their testicles and he couldn't find their ovaries. So he thought they emerged from the Earth's guts. Those sort of coils of sand that you see by rivers were actually embryonic eels boiling out of the earth. And this idea that eels must spontaneously generate was actually the main means of explaining how eels reproduce right up until the Middle Ages. It was the sort of 18th century. The Italians, who loved eel because It's a very fatty fish because they have to, the eel has to fatten itself up enormously in order to swim 4,000 miles from the rivers of Europe to the Sargasso Sea. So that makes it really, really tasty. And so the Italians, they had a real sort of fascination with eel. And it became a sort of source of national pride to try and find the gonads of the eel, which were missing. And first of all, a chap called Mondini in 1777, he found the ovaries in the end. And they were disguised in the eel in that they were these fatty fringes that looked nothing like ovaries in other creatures. So he was the one to find those. But the testicles were still missing. And there was a rather unlikely candidate who became involved in the search for the eel's testicles. And that's Sigmund Freud.
What was he doing looking for testicles on eels? I thought he was looking at people's brains and minds.
Afterwards, wasn't it?
I suppose that would drive anyone to something else. How did he get on anyway? Tell us, Lucy.
Well, I know it's a rather extraordinary thought, isn't it, really, that Freud got involved in this with this sort of like phallocentric fish. Do you know what I mean? That he's there sort of trying to desperately find the testicles and the seat of the eel's desire. And this was long before he was searching for the seat of human desire. And he was just a student, and it was 1876, and he was a student in Vienna. And he was given the task. There was a Polish professor who claimed to have found the testicles of the eel, but he had taken no documentary evidence. So it fell to Freud to try and support this claim. And he spent an entire summer as a student. It was his first ever academic job, slicing up, I think it was 400 eels over the course of several weeks in search of their testicles. And he wrote in the book, I've got these fantastic drawings, doodles by a young Sigmund Freud that he did during his sort of vain search for the eel's testicles. Because he wrote to a friend many times, and these letters are still, you can access the letters. And he says, I've been tormenting myself with these eels. And then he drew these like fantastic doodles of eels with these very Mona Lisa smiles, enigmatic smiles on their faces. And then he got drawn lots of pictures of eels' eggs in pairs that, I mean, I don't know if you were a psychiatrist, they look remarkably like a pair of ladies' breasts, actually. But anyway, it's not for me to try and psychoanalyse Freud's young drawings. Yeah, so he was given the task of finding the testicles of the eel, and he totally failed. He couldn't find them. And so that was the end of his... He moved on to other pastures and found more success with humans than eels.
I think the problem is, as with all fish, the reproductive organs are very much a ribbon-type structure. When you say testicles, of course, immediately that evokes the idea that they're spherical and you're looking for actual testes, whereas in fact what you're looking for is ribbon-like structures. And they're very obvious and they develop before reproduction. But before that, it often takes, it takes really careful dissection to try and find out what they're about. But one thing that used to fascinate me when I was a student and learning first about eels, there was this huge controversy in the 70s about American eels and European eels, and whether or not they really were two different species. And you mention in the book this idea of counting the vertebrae, actually counting the backbone structures within the leptocephali, the little larvae, and within the adults. So if I remember right, and it's a long time ago, there was a difference in vertebrae count between the American eels and the European eels. And there was a fearsome row going on about whether or not it was to do with the distance from the Sargasso Sea. So one particular theory was that all of the eels all reproduced together, which seems reasonable enough. And some of the eel larvae were caught in currents that brought them back to the west, and other larvae were caught in currents that brought them back to the east. And if you were travelling east, it was far, far longer than it was to go west. So it was all to do with the developmental time as they went across the oceans. And that the eels that ended up then in North America, the vertebrae were a couple of vertebrae short in comparison to the ones that had done the really long journey to Europe. So have they solved that now? Is that now clear from genetics or something that there are clearly American eels and European eels?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, they are distinct species. Every eel expert that I've spoken to refers to them as distinct species. So I don't know how they ended up forming that opinion. But to my knowledge, I'm a zoologist and a writer. I'm not an eel expert.
Yeah.
They are different species.
I would imagine nowadays, I mean, that was a long time ago when we didn't have the genetic tools we have now. I would imagine with genetics, you could do that fairly readily. But it used to fascinate me because, I mean, at the time, these were seriously credible scientists that were fighting with one another about this thing about distance and doing all sorts of maths on it and so on. But it was extraordinary stuff.
The American eel is Anguilla rostrata. It's classified as a separate species.
Oh, they did that in the 70s as well.
But it's still up on the on the big book sort of thing now. And it's endangered, but not critically endangered as the European one is. But your thesis about them leaving the Sargasso Sea and depending on currents where they would end up, surely that doesn't work at all, because if you have a whole lot of eels born in the Sargasso Sea from both sides of the Atlantic, the random nature of the current is going to throw some of them to America and others to Europe. So they're not going to be able to develop different numbers of vertebrae and so on and forth. That can't be the mechanism.
Well, I think at the end of the day, really what amazes me is the fact that if you do have this congregation of eels all spawning together, as far as we know, I think, and correct us if we're wrong, Lucy, this is not an active mechanism. This is a mechanism whereby it's drift that actually brings the larvae back. But the idea that you could then separate out rostrata from anguilla by means of the fact it's serendipity and, you know, that consistently they go into those currents, what it implies to me is that there are two spawning areas. It's a very big area, the Sargasso, but it implies to me that there's probably two distinct zones, because we need, you know, the same numbers or at least the same proportion of eels coming back all the time to maintain those two very different species. And this is all part and parcel of the argument that was going on in the 70s. This is exactly what they were talking about. I think they're fascinating creatures because of that. You know?
But they have, the numbers have collapsed completely. I remember my husband who lived in Clonmel in County Tipperary, and the eels were all over the place. And they wouldn't eat the eels because they reckoned the eels ate rats. And if you ate the eels, it was the equivalent of eating rats, and you couldn't possibly do this. And these eels lived beside a factory that slaughtered animals and put the blood into the river, and the eels got very big and strong and fat from doing this. But nowadays, of course, naturally we don't want slaughtered houses putting blood into rivers feeding eels. But it's more than just that. It's more than just cleaning up this kind of pollution. I mean, the whole eel population in Europe has collapsed. And is it because they don't come anymore? Are we managing to get as many as we did and banjax them here? Or are they not coming in the first instance?
And I remind you of the Battle of Jutland. It was said after the Battle of Jutland, the fishermen up there caught eels in huge numbers and fatter and bigger than any eels they had caught previously. And it was inferred that these eels ate the bodies of the sailors killed in this terrible battle.
I've been told by an eel sniggler in the UK that the best way to catch eel is to throw a dead cat into the water. Because they do love to feast on decomposing flesh.
The other way of catching eels is to use ladies' tights.
Excuse
so what
me.
You do is...
How did you find this out, Ken?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that story, but interestingly, it does work and it works very well. So what you do is you get from a very understanding lady, you get a pair of tights and you put some fish inside the tights and you make a small tubular little sausage shape and cast it out on your fishing line. And when the eel takes that into his or her mouth, there's all these little vomerine teeth up at the top, up at the roof of the mouth, and you can actually take the eel in without having to put a hook in it at all. And that's the way the Maoris fish for eels, not with tights, but with natural materials that they had available to them on the South Island. They developed this technique of actually catching eels. But like most predatory fish, they're very opportunistic. And if they get a source of food, they're going to go in and make hay out of it. But certainly in mountain streams and so on, they predominantly will feed on small fish and they'll feed on snails and so on. So they're very clean living. That's why I think you get the lovely taste off the flesh that that Lucy was mentioning. And Lucy, in terms of the status of the eels now, because there's been this big recovery plan now, goodness, it must be 10 or 12 years, maybe more, since it was put in place by the EU. Are we seeing some sort of slow recovery in terms of eel populations?
I have to say, I'm not the person to ask that question to, I'm afraid. I don't know the answer to that. I know that the reason for their decline is overfishing. It's largely to feed the Japanese market, although all of Asia eats a lot of eels. And I know that in America, eels are trapped in vast numbers and sent over to Asia. The Japanese species of eel, they have actually managed to breed that in captivity. And literally just in, it's just cost, you know, hundreds of thousands in order to make that happen. So it's a very prohibitive way of making sushi. So the only way to feed the hungry mouths that want to eat them is by catching elvers from the rivers of America and Europe and then sending them to China where they're put in farms and then fattened up.
The other thing that I find extraordinary about eels, the big, you mentioned in the book the fact that they separate out into the males and the females. Very often the males are in the lower reaches and so on. But some of these females in poor areas, areas poor in the sense of not a lot of food, they can live for extraordinary length of time. In the research station I used to run in the west of Ireland, I remember my colleague getting an eel, and you have to take out the little otoliths, the ear stones, and look for the rings inside and try and count them. And we ran out of rings at 46, but this eel was definitely 46 plus, and it was only about 6 pounds weight. These are extraordinarily long-lived, delicate creatures.
So the secret to longevity.
There was one that lived in Sweden to the age of 88.
88.
My goodness.
No, the figure is actually 155 years in a place called Brattvik.
That's disputed, though, I think.
Well, it's not so much disputed. There was a practice in Sweden, if you had a well, of capturing an eel and putting it into the well, because that would clean up all the little parasites that might contaminate the water. Now, this eel was in a well and was taken out of the well every so often and shown on Swedish television. But the test really is of how long it could live. Now, it could live 155 years before. And there's another one now catching up on it, I believe. However,
why would it die?
We have to get back to the Sargasso Sea and have a Liebestod, a great Wagnerian love orgy, and then heel over and say, well, I've done it, I can go.
Well, anyway, Lucy.
You see why Freud was interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed. It was a fascinating conversation about eels. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Ken, just before we go, you want to talk to us about the water resources management training project you're undertaking.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Derek. There's a very good new body in Ireland now, about 5 or 6 years, called Waters and Communities. And it's a great pity that this particular organisation wasn't in place before we had the debacle over and the row over water in the past. Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get communities all over the country to actually take cognizance of the water resources in their areas and to put together projects that will do two things. That will raise awareness amongst the various communities in terms of the water resources and the actual treasures that they have. And secondly, projects that can actually help to try and improve water resources in their area. So there's a leader company, a leader partnership company in County Louth. And they asked myself and my colleague Martin McGarrigle to run the first, I think, of a training programme. And basically what we did was we advertised to throughout County Louth in August, September time. And we said, if you are your community group, if you're interested in coming and learning about fresh water, about estuaries and about nearshore, and you're interested in seeing how you as a community might be able to influence people's awareness about the scarcity of water, about what we need to do to try and make sure water is clean and so on, do come along. And we've been running that now since October, and we've had the most fantastic response. And what I find really interesting is the mixture in terms of communities that we're actually getting there. So we have some really, really seriously interested farmers. We have some sheep farmers. We also have a lot of tidy townspeople. We have angling clubs. So we've a great variety of people. And we're just at the end of the training now, and we have now assembled, with their help, a whole list of different projects that they're hoping now might be funded to try and raise awareness, as I say, in these areas. And when you look at some of the rivers in County Louth, rivers like the River Dee and the River Glyde and so on, where they're flowing out, they look as if they're just a river. When you go back up into the hinterland, they have the most fantastic series of lochs and wetlands and so on, all of which people need to be aware of and need to understand how to manage these and how to deal with all of the issues that are coming from climate change in an environmental context. So it's working very well.
Now talk to me about the Freshwater Detective series.
So hopefully now part of the follow through will be that since, I think maybe 2010 now, I've been developing a series of training programs for communities called my Freshwater Detective Series. So I have 1 day courses, and then I do other courses as well where you get a certificate, and it teaches people how to actually go and walk a river or walk a stream and classify it and see how well it's doing, pick up if there are problems, and be able to designate it then as a pristine environment. Because what we're missing is the fact that under a big EU piece of legislation called the Water Framework Directive, the way our water resources are managed at the moment, and all over Europe it's the same situation, there's a limit in terms of the amount of water courses you can actually walk or sample. So each of the top layers of a river, they're actually known as first, second and third order streams. So if you have a tiny little stream coming down, that's a first order stream. If it meets another tiny stream, then the two joined together becomes a second order, and so on. So it's usually third and fourth order streams where they meet is the very top sampling point that, say, the EPA or whatever will look at. And they have no real knowledge about the little baby streams in the mountains that are so important in terms of insects and in terms of plants. They are the arteries, if you like, of the bigger rivers. And what we're doing now through the Freshwater Detective Series, and we have some great groups now out on Loch Corrib and down on the Meg that have been trained, and they're going and they're looking at all these tiny arteries and building this fantastic database of information. And they're finding all sorts of beautiful, pristine environments that the local authorities now are now aware of, and they need to actually preserve these, and they know that.
Well, more details can be found of all of the items covered on today's programme, but particularly what Ken has been speaking about just there, rte.ie/Mooney. My thanks to Ken Whelan, to Annie Lennon, to Richard Collins. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. On sound we had Sheila Neveuil, and the series producer is Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.